A name has finally been given to the American operation against ISIS, Operation Inherent Resolve, a name that, well, one military officer might have summed up by saying, quote, it's just kind of blah. The name is terrible, especially when compared to other U.S. military operation names like Iron Resolve or Warrior Resolve. Other interesting names, how about Operation Tapeworm, Operation Suicide Kings, Operation Tangerine Squeeze? What about Operation Red Bull, or the less inspired Operation Red Bull 2? Operation Dirty Harry. You have Operation Cougar, Operation Gold Digger. Kind of hidden the whole spectrum there. And then, of course, my personal favorite, Operation Wolverine Feast. The name aside, this operation is actually the face of America's new war buildup. What was supposed to be the wind down of over a decade of continuous war in Iraq and Afghanistan has suddenly morphed into a new war with ISIS, one that is already being predicted to last up to 3 decades. At least that according to former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta.
I think we're looking at kind of a 30-year war history here.
A 30-year war against a group that's only been heavily armed for, what, 2 years? To most Americans, a new 30-year war would sound like bad news, but not to everyone. No, it's music to the ears of defense contractors, who up until a few months ago were looking at huge cuts. They're not looking at cuts anymore. According to the LA Times, 3 days after U.S. warships fired 47 cruise missiles at Sunni militant targets in northern Syria, the Pentagon signed a $251 million deal to buy more Tomahawks from Raytheon. Tomahawk cruise missiles cost $1.5 million apiece. According to the AP, as of October 6, the Pentagon had spent as much as $1.1 billion on U.S. military operations against the Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. That's $1.1 billion since mid-June, including more than $62 million alone in Navy airstrikes and those Tomahawk cruise missiles. Well, as you might expect, shares for major military contractors, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and General Dynamics, all have been trading near all-time highs. Of course, it's not just the big military contractors who are reaping a windfall here. Thousands of military subcontractors who have begun laying off workers because of defense cutbacks are scrambling to rehire staff. But of course, the story doesn't end there, because many of those who are financially benefiting from military contracts are also the faces on mainstream networks calling for war. Case in point, General Jack Keane. He has regularly appeared on Fox News over the past few months promoting military action to defeat ISIS, particularly through airstrikes.
What we need to do is the air campaign has to support that. To make that work, we need air ground controllers with those units on the ground. That rises up the risk to ground troops, to be sure, but it's the only way that that air campaign in support of a counteroffensive, when we close on the enemy, will be actually effective.
Well, as Lee Feng points out in The Nation, Fox does not disclose to viewers that Keane is also a special advisor to Academy, the contractor formerly known as Blackwater, as a board member to tank and aircraft manufacturer General Dynamics, a venture partner to SCP Partners, an investment firm that partners with defense contractors, including Xvionics, a company used in Air Force drone training, and as president of his own consulting firm, GSI LLC. Well, Keane isn't alone. General Anthony Zinni, who appeared on Charlie Rose recently, is one of the largest advocates of a large deployment of American soldiers into the region to fight the Islamic State. He is on the board with BAE Systems. He also works for several military-focused private equity firms. And then there is CNN pundit Francis Townsend, a former Bush administration official, who's also calling for more military engagement against the Islamic State. Townsend holds positions in two investment firms with defense company holdings, MacAndrews and Forbes, and Monument Capital Group. She also serves as an advisor to defense contractor Decision Sciences. Obviously, these individuals have every right to work for whatever industry they choose, but for media to allow them to champion the buildup of war while not disclosing their own financial gain is troublesome. To talk more about the windfall for defense contractors, I was joined earlier by Robert Levinson, a senior defense analyst at Bloomberg Government, and Stephen Miles, advocacy director for Win Without War. He also co-authored an article titled Stop Saying the Pentagon Can't Pay for Our Wars. In it, he wrote this, quote, here's the reality. Over the past few years, the Budget Control Act has kept the Pentagon's base budget relatively flat, at just under half of $1 trillion. Nonetheless, the Pentagon has found ways to avoid fiscal discipline, and Congress has let them, twice offsetting a portion of the Act's mandatory defense reductions with other non-defense savings. I began by asking Stephen if he thinks that the idea that we have to take the restraints off of defense spending is based on a false narrative.
Absolutely. Look, the reality is that the Pentagon is not short on cash. As you said, the Pentagon itself has a base budget of right around $500 billion. On top of that, they have a war spending account, what's called in Washington jargon the Overseas Contingency Operations Account. That's about $85 billion right now. Interestingly enough, the next year's expenses in Afghanistan, which that account primarily is supposed to pay for, that's only supposed to be about $20 to $25 billion. So you've got somewhere right now in the neighborhood of $60 billion in there that's just kind of floating around with nothing to do. We're talking in Iraq and Syria about operations. We spent $1.1 billion. We'll be talking about probably a couple billion by the time the year is done. This is a rounding error in some ways at the Pentagon. The reality is they have plenty of money for this operation.
While that may be true, I mean, $60 billion, you'll burn through that pretty quickly at the rate that they're going right now. $1.1 billion up until October 6th. That's a pretty steady pace in terms of spending.
Well, they're spending right now about $7.5 million a day. So it's $1.1 billion over the last couple months.
Right.
Again, $3, $4, $5 billion potentially over the next year. The real driver of cost is when you do troop deployments. So the fact that this is a low troop-involved conflict, that we're talking primarily about airstrikes, about air munitions, that's not nearly as expensive as the type of large ground deployments that we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan in the past. Coincidentally, though, it is very good for the bottom lines of the contractors that make the missiles that get fired, that make the planes that fire those missiles, make the drones that fly overhead. And that's why you're seeing those stock prices hitting record highs.
Robert, as all this is happening, you would think that there wouldn't be any military waste right now, right? But think again. Barry Donegan at BenSwan.com reports the Defense Department just completed a fire sale of 2008. The Defense Department spent $486 million. They bought 20 of these G-222 transport planes, intending to donate them to the Afghan Air Force. Well, recently, 16 of those planes were scrapped, and the resulting raw materials were sold for $32,000 at a rate of 6 cents per pound. The planes had only been used to fly 234 flight hours between January and September of 2012. Every government agency has waste, certainly. But why should the American public continue to just blow billions of dollars on equipment that seems to become antiquated faster than an iPhone does?
Well, I don't know if the equipment becomes antiquated that fast, but you're absolutely right. There certainly is a tremendous amount of waste. I mean, the Pentagon is this huge bureaucracy that spends all kind of money. We know that the Pentagon still can't be audited, and so they're not even sure where all of the money is going. So certainly, the Pentagon spends a lot more money than every other government agency by orders of magnitude. And so, yeah, it does waste a lot of money. There's no question about that.
And part of this, you know, we look at what's happening already with the Islamic State, those F-22 Raptors, I believe that they are, the new stealth Raptors that are being used. It's always about having the newest, the best equipment, which obviously benefits these military contractors as well, because they're constantly pumping out, new materials, new weapons, new planes, new missiles. That's the idea behind it. But in a lot of these cases, do we need the absolute newest, best, shiniest equipment?
Well, you know, that's a real tough question, because we're Americans. We're a wealthy country. We're a high technology country. And if you ask Americans if we're sending young men and women into harm's way, do we want the best system or do we want the second best system? You know, our systems are awfully expensive. They come in over budget. They're delayed a lot. But not a lot of people say our systems aren't the best ones out there. They're often very, very good systems. Yes, they cost a lot of money. But sometimes the payoff is that a lot more Americans come home, and our systems don't tend to fail in combat very much.
You make a good point when you say we're a wealthy nation, but at the same time, we're also a broke nation. I mean, virtually all of our military spending is deficit spending. I mean, we don't have the infrastructure to be able to continue to pay for this over a long period. We're accruing enormous amounts of debt associated with it. At some point, do you not think that there's going to be some kind of backlash from the American public that says, let's get some of this spending under control? Or when you keep seeing videos of ISIS cutting someone's head off, do you say, it doesn't matter, spend what you need to spend.
No, I think it's a serious problem. I mean, one of the things that's been unique about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and since is we haven't paid for them. You know, previous American wars, we either raise taxes or we sell war bonds. In other words, the American people have to commit to this. These past few wars, we haven't said that. We've cut taxes and at the same time spending a lot of money on war. That's unique in American history. I think it's a problem, especially when you have an all-volunteer military. It means a lot of Americans don't really have skin in the game here, except for the young men and women who were deploying. And I think that's a problem. I think the American people need to be asked to pay for these wars. And if they're not willing to pay for them, then maybe we ought to be rethinking them.
Well, and it certainly doesn't allow you to continue to kick the can down the roads, as the proverbial phrase is overused. Mm-hmm. But that's really what happens here. When you say to one generation of Americans, fight now and we'll figure out how to pay for it later, doesn't that kind of give people, Stephen, a cop-out here to be able to say, all right, well, we'll take care of it. And what we have to do right now, the immediacy of stopping this threat is more important than figuring out how to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. Look, Americans want to spend what it takes to be safe. But, you know, we're absolutely right to talk about the costs of these wars, and not just the costs we're going to pay today, but the costs we're going to pay down the road. You know, the last two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan not only had massive financial costs on the outset, but they're costs that we're going to be paying for decades to come. You know, we only recently are peaking in terms of the cost for the veterans from the Vietnam War. We've got 30 to 40 more years of veterans' costs rising until they peak sometime 30 to 40 years from now. There's going to be tens of billions of dollars that we owe to the veterans from those wars that we know is going to come. Now we have another war. We know there's going to be more costs, and I couldn't agree more. We need to have an honest conversation about how we're going to pay for that.
And of course, that doesn't even take into account the issues with PTSD, suicide, all those other things that are emotional, psychological issues that we're going to have to pay for as well. I do want to ask you guys about this, though. You saw the explanation we had about the military experts who do not disclose, or they're not disclosed as having financial gains. From a journalism point of view, that's a huge problem. I mean, clearly. But my question is this how a lot of these guys get on the boards of these big defense contracting companies? Are ties to media, connections there, where they're able to go in front of the American public and essentially sell the war to people, which ultimately reaps a financial windfall for their companies?
No, my personal opinion, I don't think so. I've known a lot of general officers, and the truth is they have a lot of expertise, and when they retire, and you know, general officers, surprisingly for a lot of people, I think, are not paid what senior executives are paid. They're still government employees, and they're not paid a huge amounts of money. I mean, they're well compensated, but then they can go on these boards and things, and they're recruited because of their expertise in the systems and their connections to people who are still serving, members of Congress and all of that. I don't think most of them are hired because of the media. I think that's another nice benefit. But I think what pulls them in is their experience with these programs and their connections to sort of the defense industrial complex, if you will.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with who you know, right?
That's absolutely.
Obviously, those connections, those ties.
What I want to say, though, is that the inverse of that is not necessarily true, that you find that the ones who speak out about it, they don't hold those jobs at those boards. Speaking out about those issues, speaking out against the wars, that's a surefire way to find yourself out of those jobs on those boards. And so, while I agree, it's not necessarily why people end up there, speaking out on the other side of those things sure does come at a financial cost.
Well, and if I were on the boards, I'd want you off as well. If you were speaking out against the war, it's bad for business. Mm-hmm. Stephen Miles, Advocacy Director for Win Without War. Robert Levinson, a Senior Defense Analyst at Bloomberg Government. Thank you both.
Thanks.